Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Christina Hellman, and I represent the petitioner Brian Oust. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The first thing that someone is told in Miranda warnings is that they have the right to remain silent. And that's an implicit promise that silence will not be used later to harm them. But Mr. Oust was convicted in this case in large part because he exercised that right to silence. The prosecutor used the silence against him to impeach him in cross-examination, which damaged Mr. Oust's credibility before the jury. And the prosecutor urged the jury to infer guilt from Mr. Oust's silence. Our Constitution prohibits a prosecutor from infringing on a defendant's rights in that manner. And that's why
you do concede that he was advised that he had a right to remain silent, but he didn't remain silent, did he?
Yes, he was advised, Your Honor, that he had a right to remain silent, and no, he did not remain completely silent, mute, in the face of questions. Okay. But the answers and responses he gave were equivalent to silence under this Court's case law and under the Supreme Court's case law, and he did not give any statement regarding the alleged rape that could have permissibly been used to impeach him at trial.
Okay. Could you address the circumstances? This is a collateral review under AEDPA.
Correct.
And the trial court's ruling is based on what was presented to him at the time, which was an account of what was said in the course of that interview, when there was both a videotape and a transcript available, which was not made available to the trial judge, as he repeatedly said. So why is it that how can we conclude that the trial judge's ruling was clearly unreasonable or an unreasonable application?
There are two rulings on the mistrial, Your Honor. The first is when the defense attorney objects in opening statements, and that's based on the prosecutor's assertion that Mr. Oust was given every opportunity. There's a second ruling on the mistrial, which is a renewed motion after the government's close of the case in chief, at which point the prosecutor tells the court that what he plans to elicit is a comment on silence.
Yeah.
Both of those comments prove that the Doyle violation occurred. However, should this court conclude that there was not sufficient evidence before the trial court, that proves the claim of ineffectiveness that's also before the court in this case. Because in the face of repeated statements by the court that it didn't have enough information, counsel failed to provide that available transcript or that available video. But our position is first that there was sufficient evidence before the court to grant the mistrial.
Here's how I'm inclined to see the case as it was in front of the trial judge. The trial judge knows that Mr. Oust remained silent. He knows that Mr. Oust remained silent after the Miranda warning had been given. But as I read what the trial judge is saying, is he thinks in order for Mr. Oust's silence to be protected, that is to say, to avoid comment on the silence, that Mr. Oust needed to invoke his Miranda rights clearly by saying something like, I invoke my Miranda rights, I want to see my lawyer. But that strikes me as just a flat-out error of law on the part of the state trial judge. Yes, if what he wants is a lawyer and the questioning to cease, yes, he's got to invoke that clearly. And if he doesn't invoke it clearly, any inculpating statement used thereafter, I'm afraid it comes in. I understand that. But he's just keeping quiet. And I think the state trial judge just misunderstood the law. If you are going to keep quiet and protect your rights under Doyle, because Doyle says it's implicit in the Miranda warning that your silence won't be used against you, you don't need to see anything. You just need to keep your mouth shut. So I don't think that the state trial judge needed the transcript at all, because the way I read him, he thought he needed it to see whether the Miranda right had been invoked by, I want to see my lawyer.
That, Your Honor, that's absolutely right, and that's a key and critical distinction in this case versus many of the other cases that involve Miranda. This is a case about silence. This is not a case about statements. The defendant here was not seeking to exclude statements from trial that he had made by pointing to specific invocations and saying that everything after that should be thrown out. We're not focusing on what the cop did in this case. We're focusing on what the prosecutor did, which was make the comments. So there was sufficient warning for the trial court that there was a Doyle violation. The idea that he was focused on this issue of voluntariness, which is implicit in his...
Right. Right. This is ADEPA, and your contention, as I understand you, is that this conduct here violated Doyle. You're hanging your hat on Doyle, right?
Doyle informed, yes, Your Honor.
I mean, you have to prove a departure from a Supreme Court decision.
That's right.
And because this is ADEPA, and you are saying that you are relying on Doyle. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, then how can you rely on Doyle when the facts of that case were that he did remain silent?
Your Honor, respectfully, that's not entirely accurate.
Okay.
The defendants in Doyle, and I have two answers to that. First, the defendants in Doyle did make some statements, although they were limited. One of the defendants in Doyle did make statements. And second, a habeas petitioner, can win a case when a Supreme Court principle is unreasonably applied in his case, and we don't need to have identical facts to have that happen. So law is clearly established when that principle, the Doyle principle, can be extended to this case and directly applied to this case without needing to be tailored or modified or without having to shift somehow fundamentally.
The progeny of Doyle seem to hang their hats on the fact that in Doyle the defendant did not make a statement, remained silent. I'm talking about, all the three or four cases that followed, Anderson and Jenkins, and et cetera. You are saying that I am misinterpreting Doyle because it wasn't a remaining silent case.
Your Honor, respectfully, I apologize. I'm not saying you're misinterpreting Doyle. I'm saying that the fact that Mr. Oust said some words, said I understand in response to questions, or said okay, or responded to certain questions, does not take him out of the protections of Doyle. Because as to the critical question in this case, which was the issue of the alleged rape, he did remain silent. He provided no statements. And so although he did talk, that's true, which is a difference between cases in which defendants completely remain mute and answer no questions, the mere fact that he talked does not take him outside of that case.
Right. Okay. Why don't we hear from the state, and then you'll have a chance to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Inga Wells for respondent. I want to just start by clarifying it's our position that the state trial court's decision was not an unreasonable application of Doyle, because what the court found and what occurred in this case was the petitioner was given Miranda warnings. He voluntarily answered questions after being given those Miranda warnings, and therefore any omissions in the statements that he made were fair game for the state to argue at trial.
So your position is that it's consistent with Doyle to say that as soon as he begins answering questions, his silence on other matters can be used against him?
No. I think that it is possible to selectively invoke your right to silence on a particular subject matter.
Okay. And that's Doyle. Your view of Doyle is that it is possible, under Supreme Court case law, to selectively invoke your right to silence.
My view of Doyle is that it was a case where the defendant said nothing at all. And so it was
did he not even say, did he not even answer a question as to what his name was?
I don't think the record indicates whether he answered a question about what his name was, but I think
I bet he said his name.
I'm sure he said his name. Yeah. But I think the holding in Doyle and the assumption that the court made in Doyle was that these defendants didn't say anything about the substance of what had occurred. But clearly subsequent cases say that you can selectively invoke.
And I would agree with that. So the question is whether he successfully did that.
Correct. Yeah. And it's our position that in this case he did not.
Yeah.
I have real trouble with that. If you read the transcript, he is very, very careful not to go into the circumstances of that evening. It was not an unresponsiveness or willing to flesh out and volunteer and say, it was consensual sex. He wouldn't talk about it, and he was, I don't know how much more under this kind of questioning he could have been clear. And that's why I focused back on what the trial judge had before him. He didn't have the transcript. He had the prosecutor's characterization of what went on. But I find it very difficult to read that transcript and say that this guy wasn't selectively invoking his right to silence, and that what was done was an inference of guilt from his supposed failure to come forward with a statement that it was consensual sex when he wouldn't say anything about it. In fact, his first statement out of his mouth was, I'm willing to talk, sort of. And then he made clear throughout that he wasn't going to talk about what happened that night.
I have a couple of responses to that. I think, first of all, he did talk about what happened over the course of that day with regard to other things.
Absolutely.
Simply not whether they had engaged in sex, consensual or otherwise.
He talked about how he'd been set up by her once before, and he was very, what had she done? He doesn't know what the cops know, but he's not going to, because he knows it's dangerous territory to get into talking about what went on in the room that night. And he makes that, I think, abundantly clear on the record.
I agree that he was being very careful about what he would say to the officer as he was trying to get a sense of what it was that that detective knew about what had gone on.
You agree. I thought you did. You do not agree, then, that he selectively invoked his Miranda rights?
I don't believe that he did, because what he said to the detective was, I don't know if I should talk about that. Right. I don't know if I should talk about that,
and
repeatedly.
So he didn't.
And
what the state said was, in the face of his saying, I don't know whether I should talk about that because I'm worried about it, they used that to say that he was the jury should infer guilt. And I don't know what else you can say about, commenting on somebody's invocation of the right not to talk about some aspect of what went on. If that isn't selective invocation of Miranda, I don't, it's...
Well, and certainly, if this court concludes that because of the record that was before the trial court in this case, which was without the transcript and without the videotape, that no deference is owed to that trial court's decision and that this court is going to review de novo, I think that the issue then turns precisely on whether or not those statements about, I don't know if I should talk about this, selectively invoked or not. And if this court concludes that they did, then under those circumstances, I have to concede that that would then be Doyle error, and the question becomes whether that error was harmless, And it's our position that in this case it was not, in light of the evidence that was presented to the jury in this case.
Oh, boy, that's a tough road to hoe for you, because
I thought you said it was not harmless. You just said it's not harmless.
I misspoke.
You misspoke.
I meant it was harmless.
Were, okay, I thought you were making a complete concession.
No.
Yeah,
no.
Right. Yeah, I guess I didn't hear you correctly. I heard what you meant to say rather than what you said.
You invoked your rights.
Yes, I did.
Well, you're kind of between Sill and Charybdis on this one. Either the trial judge erred based on the information the trial judge had. That is to say, you know, he kept his mouth shut, and he kept his mouth shut, and that was the end of it. And he doesn't matter whether he invokes Miranda by saying, I want to see my lawyer clearly or not, because he's just keeping his mouth shut. Or if the trial judge was right to say, well, I want to see the way in which he kept his mouth shut. Fair enough. Then it's IAC. Because, his lawyer had the transcript and should have handed it over to the judge. Here, judge, look at this. He kept his mouth shut every step of the way.
I want to back up to the first part of what you said, which is that the trial judge understood that he had kept his mouth shut. I don't think that's what the record reflects.
Yeah.
Then that
turns it into IAC.
I think
the defense lawyer should have handed over the transcript at that point.
I think what the trial court understood, at least from its ruling, was that the defendant had been given Miranda warnings, that he made a voluntary statement in following those Miranda warnings, and then at some point did invoke, actually he requested an attorney, but questioning stopped. That's what the trial court understood, and I think the court's ruling based on that information was not an unreasonable application of Doyle.
Yeah. So if the trial judge had seen the transcript, which we now have all read, and the defense attorney had, what should the trial judge have done had he seen the transcript?
Our position would be the same, which is that the trial judge, in reviewing the transcript, would have said that the statements that he made about, I don't know if I should talk about this, were not a selective invocation of his right to remain silent.
And what if we think that the trial judge would have obeyed the law, would have obeyed Doyle and the progeny, and that our view of Doyle and his progeny is that this was clearly a successful invocation of the right to remain silent as to certain subjects? I mean, here we are hypothesizing a judge's ruling rather than dealing with an actual ruling, and I would prefer to hypothesize that the trial judge would have gotten it right.
I think that depends, again,
so
on...
I'm deferring to the trial judge. He probably would have got it right if he'd had the transcript.
That gets us back again to whether those statements by the defendant were a selective invocation or not. And obviously, if this Court concludes that they were, I think that drives your decision on both of these claims, because they are, as you pointed out, interconnected.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Response?
Thank you, Your Honors. I have just 2 points to make. First, the statements were selective invocations, but they were actually more than that. They were the equivalent of silence. They were not responsive. They did not provide a story regarding the alleged rape. They were indications that Mr. Ast did not want to talk to the officer about that issue. And under Doyle and under this Court's subsequent precedent, clearly applying the clearly established principles of Doyle, that was okay for Mr. Ast to do. And the second point is that it was not harmless error what happened, because this was a case about he said, she said. The evidence was equivocal. It suggested that they had sex, but that Your Honor, did you have a question?
Well, I'm not sure that it's a question of what she said. The question here was her appearance. She had a bruise on her face. There were striations on her arms that could indicate that there was duct tape. So I just had a problem. You're saying that all it was he said, she said. I have a problem with that.
All right, Your Honor, yes, there was physical evidence, but there were competing interpretations of that physical evidence. The prosecutor had their experts. The defense had their experts. Mr. Oust testified and provided explanations that were about some of the evidence that the prosecutor said suggested his guilt, which meant that it was all the more important for him and his credibility to remain intact, and that didn't happen because of the prosecutor's comments.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both sides for your arguments. You know, Oust versus Seeley. The next case on the argument calendar is Nice versus States versus Harub. Just to alert everyone, we'll take a break at the end of this next argument. So we'll take a break between Harub and King.
Thank you.